well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program. We're going to be talking with Stephen Gutowski from The Reload here in just a moment or two. A couple of topics of conversation. Going to talk about last week's oral arguments before the Supreme Court in Smith & Wesson versus Mexico. We've got new NICS numbers to talk about. Gun sales down quite a bit in February of 2025 compared to February of 2024. What does that mean for the firearms industry? Again, we'll talk about that with Stephen Gutowski here in just a moment. Before we get started, though, I do want to mention something I talked about yesterday at the end of the program. This fantastic event that's going to be taking place. I said it was going to be on April 18th. It is not. It's going to be Saturday, April 19th at the Boxborough Regency Hotel and Conference Center in Boxborough, Massachusetts. It is the Gun Owners Action League's The Battle Continues Dinner, which they say is going to be the prestigious Second Amendment event of the year, celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Battles of Lexington and Concord. I am honored to be one of the speakers at this event. And as a matter of fact, you can actually sit with me. I'm going to be heading up the Paul Revere table, which I am just super duper excited about. But there are going to be some great speakers. So Jim Wallace, obviously from the Gun Owners Action League, is going to be there. Doug Hamlin, NRA Executive Vice President. Dick Heller of, you know, Heller versus DC. Toby Leary, who owns Cape Gunworks and is also the head of the Civil Rights Coalition in Massachusetts, taking on via referendum the sweeping gun control laws that were passed last year. Alan West going to be there as well from the Second Amendment Institute. Adam Kraut from the Second Amendment Foundation is going to be among these speakers. And you can take part. You can find out more information. Just go to gold.org/250dinner. And that's the numbers 250dinner. Again, this is going to be Saturday, April 19th. Cocktail hour starts at 4 p.m. The event itself kicks off at 5 p.m. I'm very pleased that the attire is going to be business casual because that means I don't have to go out and buy a tie. So I am truly looking forward to being up there in Massachusetts what is a historic occasion, right? The 250th anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. I'm a history nerd anyway, but to be there on such hallowed ground on that anniversary, I think it's going to be really special. So, again, I would encourage you to go to this dinner. Again, gold.org/250dinner. You don't have to be a Massachusetts resident to attend. They do let out-of-staters like myself into this dinner. And I hope that I will get a chance to see you there at the Boxborough Regency Hotel and Conference Center on Saturday, April 19th. That is just one, by the way, of several events that the Gun Owners Action League is going to be doing over that weekend. They've got a number of events earlier in the day on Saturday as well. So go to gold.org and you can find out more. All right, let's start the conversation now with Stephen Gutowski, founder of The Reload. A lot to discuss in terms of Second Amendment news and information. Take a look and a listen. Stephen, it's good to see you. Thanks so much for coming on the program, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we've got a lot to talk about. So let's start with the deadline here for Attorney General Pam Bondi, right? So I guess it was Monday was the day that she is supposed to have completed her examination of all of the ATF rules and regulations, DOJ policies, their stances on, you know, current litigation. We haven't heard anything from the Attorney General yet. And frankly, I'm not all that surprised that was the deadline for her to, you know, complete her investigation. Then, according to Trump's executive order, she needs to talk with his domestic policy advisor and formulate a plan based on what she's discovered. So I don't know when we the public are going to get a chance to, you know, see what she's uncovered and where this is going. But I would hope that within the next week or so, we will actually know what this investigation will lead to in terms of policy choices here for the Trump administration, right?
Yeah, I would expect so. I mean, they have been a little bit, I would say, to this point, keeping things kind of on the lower end of the publicity scale for gun-related stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the executive order itself is kind of a good example of that. It happened on a Friday night, which, you know, in the news business, we call that the Friday night news dump, right?
Right.
So doesn't mean that they're not going to do, you know, pro-gun reforms. It just means that they might not be at the things that get put into big speeches that Trump has or whatnot. Like, I mean, he didn't mention gun policy in his joint address to Congress at all. Sort of, that's how I've been, you know, seeing these things so far. It's not a high priority issue that they're talking a lot about, but it doesn't mean they're not going to do things that gun rights activists want. We did get a little bit of a maybe preview of what might be in there. It's kind of a negative story that came out from the New York Times on Monday that related to this idea. It sounds, if you read the piece, the idea sounds like they're going to try and actually use the restoration of rights process that already exists under federal law for people who are prohibited persons, and that they had come up with a list of names. They whittled it down to only like 9 names by the end, but it sounded like they were planning on making this a more automated process. You know, something people might not be aware of is that if you've been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor, domestic violence, or some have been adjudicated mentally ill, you're some other prohibited person, there is technically a process to get your gun rights back. It's just one that has never really been used by the federal government, doesn't get funding, and the DOJ doesn't make it a priority. So it sounds like that was in the works. And then there was some effort to get Mel Gibson put on the list of people who should be have their gun rights restored. He was convicted of domestic violence misdemeanor or pled no contest to one in 2011. And he's been friends with Donald Trump. Trump made him like an ambassador to Hollywood. And so I guess there was some internal fight over that ended with a career official being fired. That was the New York Times piece. But if you read the piece, that sort of gives you some insight into maybe one of the things they may be doing. But the Times reported that it was supposed to be announced on Monday, and then they just didn't do it, maybe because of this whole internal fight over Mel Gibson. But that's one thing we've gotten an indication on.
Yeah. And I think we've gotten, you know, I think the pause that DOJ has requested in some of the ongoing litigation challenging these ATF rules, I think that's another indication that at least there's not going to be a knee-jerk defense and a knee-jerk continuation of Merrick Garland's policies.
Sure.
You know, but again, I mean, there's some contentious issues. You know, I'm curious to see how Bondi will come down on things like defending the current statute. You have to be 21 to buy a handgun, given that she, you know, advocated for raising the age to purchase a firearm of any kind in Florida from 18 to 21. Some of these prohibited persons cases, I think, are going to be interesting, you know, and
you might not want to like restore those people's like Brian Range, for instance, the case out of Pennsylvania.
Right.
You might not want to restore, if you're a gun rights advocate, you might not want to restore his rights because that undoes the case. And I think a lot of people want to see that case get to the Supreme Court for an actual ruling. So there, you know, there's some stuff to consider either way on that. But I think you're right overall, right? I think the only reason you do the executive order this way instead of just kind of plowing forward and taking the actions like they've done in a lot of other cases is to give the AG a little more flexibility on exactly what she wants to pursue and what she maybe doesn't want to pursue. So it will be interesting to see what they do.
It will. And, you know, going back to Brian Range, I mean, that's a really good point. At the same time, you know, if you're Brian Range, you don't necessarily want to be the poster child. I mean, like, it's fine, but if you could have your rights restored without having to risk the Supreme Court saying, no, actually, you don't get your rights back. You know, if you're Brian Range, you probably go with door number one, right? So,
oh, sure, absolutely.
That's also a tension here, right? Because we talk about things as Second Amendment advocates a lot of times at like the 50,000 foot level, right? How does this impact all of us as gun owners? But when you're talking about these individual cases and these individual plaintiffs or individual defendants, you know, the calculus changes because not every one of those individuals is looking to make precedent, right? They're just looking to get their rights back. They're looking to have their life restored to some semblance of what it was a couple of years ago. And they don't necessarily want to be Dick Heller or Otis McDonald or, right? That's not their motivation.
And he may be on the New York Times. We haven't heard from the DOJ on this yet. And I'll put out a comment request here shortly, but You know, he may be on that list of nine people that was in this New York Times piece. We don't know. You know, some of these high profile incidents with the lawsuits attached to them may already be on that list. It's just, yeah, the question then becomes like, obviously, if you're Brian Range, yeah, you probably want to be on the list. And maybe if you're gun rights activists, if they make this an the other fight they were having besides Mel Gibson was this idea, it sounds like, instead of doing a case by case reevaluation for this restoration of rights process, that some people wanted to do a more automated version, which may be what gun rights activists actually want to see in the end as policy, right? For this sort of thing, like if your conviction was nonviolent, if you served your time, you know, that you'd have a list of preconditions, presumably. But you know, if you want any substantial number of people to actually have their rights restored, a case by case review is probably not what you're looking for in that situation, even if it is a slight improvement over the status quo where you just basically don't have the opportunity.
Any system, to get right. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what they actually do. But we haven't heard anything official yet.
Right. Okay. That's a really good segue. Speaking of not having heard anything, Supreme Court still silent on Snope, still silent on Ocean State Tactical. And I'm not going to ask you at this point, Stephen. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going on with those cases. We're just all kind of waiting to see what happens. But we did see oral arguments in Smith & Wesson versus Mexico last week. And I was actually not able to listen to the oral arguments at the time. So I was kind of going on your commentary and what a lot of folks who had heard these oral arguments before I had the chance to actually listen. And I mean, I got to tell you, Stephen, like this is one of those cases where I could legitimately see this being a 9-0 decision in favor of Smith & Wesson. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think it's extremely plausible.
You know what? I actually had the same thought as far as like it could go that way. That was the feeling I got listening to oral arguments. Just, you know, especially somebody like Jackson, you know, Brown Jackson speaking up. Now, she had hard questions for both sides, I would say. Mm-hmm. She was, interrogating the idea that maybe aided and abetted is broader in the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms statute than it is elsewhere in federal law. You know, she had that idea brought up to Smith & Wesson's lawyers. And then, but on the other side, she was pretty aggressive against Mexico's lawyer. With the idea that their lawsuit is effectively just trying to make the courts dictate gun law, you know, which was the whole purpose of the PLCAA to prevent that. And that, right. That's like what Jackson said directly. And she's, I would say, you know, so far in these gun cases that we've heard her in oral arguments, I think she's been the furthest left on the issue.
Yeah.
Of any of the nine justices. And so to have her being that serious in her questioning of Mexico's the core of their case, that's what made me feel like maybe they will go 9-0. And now maybe it'll be a relatively I don't think you get a 9-0 sweeping decision, right? I think you might get a 9-0, you know, the proximate cause, you know, you'll get a very technical decision on,
right,
you know,
and you'll have Smith some concurring Wesson opinions where, you know, yeah, right, oh, this is a horrible problem and it needs to be addressed, but this isn't the right avenue to address it. I think it just has
to do with that chain of events that Mexico has in this case, from trying to say that Smith & Wesson making a gun is the cause of the harm that they're claiming from cartel violence way down the line. Mm-hmm. When they're not really accusing Smith & Wesson of doing anything directly illegal. They don't have specific claims of how the guns get from the legal American sales process to Mexico's cartels illegally, right? They have a broad claim that this happens, right, and that it's, you know, foreseeable that it will happen, given that it has happened in the past. But they don't have like, oh, it's because these specific deals are a problem, and Smith and Wesson knows they're a problem, and they don't care, or they're actively encouraging them to do illegal, you know, gun sales to Mexican cartels. That was another problem that you saw from the liberal justices pointed out. Like, there just isn't a lot of specificity to this claim. Mm-hmm. You know, and when we're talking, they're at the high level of this case, right? This isn't a merits claim. It's really the lowest bar Mexico is going to face in this process if it does continue.
Yeah.
But they all still seem fairly skeptical. Now, I will say, I thought that was the general takeaway from most people. So I had Professor Drew Stevenson on because I thought he had a slightly different take. You know, he comes from obviously the more of a left perspective on guns, but he's a fairly serious thinker on these things. And he was pretty detailed in his decision. I had him on the podcast this week, and yeah, even he thought Mexico was probably not going to win. But he did think there. One interesting thing I will say that I took away from his observations is that in this kind of case, you often get in these more high profile, more, you know, cases that are more likely to split along ideological lines. You tend to get justices who've clearly made up their mind and are just kind of advocating for their one side or the other through their questioning. You didn't really get that in this case. So, you know, that is one interesting thing to note about it. You know, you didn't have like Alito out there basically making Smith and Wesson's case for them. But at the end, or Jackson making Mexico's case for them.
Yeah.
It just did. But overall, yeah, I still think it felt like Mexico's probably not winning this one. They're probably going to have this case tossed out, and which will be interesting because, you know, they could have done this with the Remington case, the Sandy Hook case.
Yeah.
Right. If you remember that, the Massachusetts Supreme Court said, OK, this can go forward. We don't know that you have a strong merits claim, but you can try.
Yeah.
And that was appealed to the Supreme Court and they denied hearing that case. And and then that went on to have a huge settlement, not based on the merits claims necessarily, but, and so this time around, I wonder if that factored in and what the effect will be, because the effect of Sandy Hook was you got a lot more of those cases.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and
if this one loses, are they going to stop doing it?
I mean, I don't think they're going to stop, but they'll obviously have to look for another legal argument to try to get around. Yeah. Right. Yeah. At least temporarily. And of course, I mean, that'd be good news for the firearms industry, right? $10 billion. That's what Mexico is seeking. And, you know, I the firearms industry, I think it's fair to say, could use that verdict to their benefit, right? We are seeing the numbers come out. I just saw the numbers for February. Still over a million NICS checks performed, according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation. They look at the adjusted numbers, but the numbers are down from February of last year. And you and I were talking off air yesterday. This was the first month that basically down below pre-pandemic levels. Is that right?
It's definitely one of the first that has really been below pre-pandemic levels. It was the second worst February in 13 years. And the only other one that was worse was 2018, which might get into maybe a bit of the theme we're going to get into as to why this is happening. But, you know, to me, you know, certainly, and obviously 2018 was when Donald Trump was president, and there's what everybody talks about is the Trump slump and this idea that demand was depressed because people were not concerned about new gun laws passing. And, you know, you can have a discussion about whether that's the right, that's generally probably the right attitude in a Trump administration with Republican controlled Congress. There may be some undervalued risks with that, given his reaction to major mass shootings in the past. But overall, it makes sense that people are not as worried and they're not rushing out to buy guns in anticipation of them being banned. And that was a lot of the reason people thought the depressed nature of gun sales during his first administration occurred. But, you know, and that does make sense. And you probably will see that kind of effect going from Biden to Trump this time around. But I think there may be a more serious issue at play, because, you know, the idea during the pandemic was that, you know, that 2020 sales spike was massive spike, right? Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of new gun owners, millions of new gun owners that came in. And so the thought was, you know, that should be able to sustain a new floor for the industry for demand, because there's more people who own guns now. And you've seen this, I don't think that was just an industry claim, right? I mean, you've seen that reflected in polling and in studies that have been done by, you know, universities as well as industry analysis. So we should have a higher level for, and it was just about, for years now, we've been waiting to see, okay, where is the new floor? Where is it going to level out at? And if February is down at levels below 2013, you know, that's, what are you supposed to take away from that? Now, maybe it's just a blip. It's 1 month. right?
Yeah. And I mean, you're right. I mean, and I would not put, I would want to see what happens in March. I'd want to see what happens in April. I think you also have to look at, you know, things outside of the firearms industry, right? So you can look at consumer confidence. You can look at concerns about inflation creeping up again. You know, I think Americans' confidence in the economy right now is not where the Trump administration wants it to be. Certainly not where a lot of Americans want it to be, right? And so that may be reflective as well. So you got a combination of factors, right, where people are less concerned about threats to their Second Amendment rights, but also less able to afford to go out and buy a new gun right now, even if they want one. Yeah, that might be something that maybe they're waiting on their tax refund. Maybe we'll see what happens again in March and April. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, the numbers are what they are for February, right? The question is whether or not that's the start of a trend, or as you say, whether this is a blip, somewhat anomalous.
And guns are not perishable items, right? You know, people who ran out and bought a gun in 2020 because they were concerned about their safety for one of the myriad of reasons that happened. There are a lot of different reasons that got a lot of people to want to buy a gun in 2020, right? We all remember a lot of the different things that happened. Somebody who's motivated by a gun purely on the security concerns, you don't need five guns for that necessarily. Right. You can have one gun and feel that you're confident that you can protect yourself. Now, obviously, if you're into guns like you or I, you realize that you could have a gun for every different purpose, right? Just like shoes. You could have different shoes you might only need one pair of shoes in practical sense. But obviously hiking boots different from dress shoes. And it's same thing with guns, but not everybody gets into that. Right. And so you may have a lot of people who went out, bought a gun for safety, and now they feel, okay, at least I have this gun for safety.
Right.
I don't need to go out and buy five more. But that is, to some degree, I think, an industry failure to get those people back into the stores. Right. I mean, why that implies that the new owners are less inclined than the more traditional owners to go back again and again.
Yeah.
Or at least not at the same rates, maybe. So that would be a concern if you're in the industry. Like, why are we seeing these lower levels? We should have a floor that's higher than 2018, 2019, 20, or 20, even 2013, right? But
right.
It could just be one bad year. February was it the beginning of some of the stock market crash that we've seen going on, and so economic concerns could just be the overriding thing. But I do start to wonder at some point whether this is a more serious long-term concern that you'd start to have if you're in the gun industry.
I think that we'll probably, again, let's wait and see what happens in March. Let's wait and see what happens in April. And then I think, it'll be, that'll be much more evident. But, I mean, there's the old, what's the old line about, you can have guns or butter, right? Well, these days, maybe you can have guns or eggs.
Unless you live on a farm.
Unless you live on a farm, in which case, yes. I'm down to three hens, but I'm getting three eggs a day. So that's it,
everybody. That's right. Just have a farm, or have your parents have a farm with chickens, and you'll be fine.
There you go.
But I will say too that the industry is probably better positioned this time around than it was for the first so-called Trump slump.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people expected Hillary Clinton to win that election. And so there was a ramp up in production back then.
Right.
That then went into a depressed demand state that hurt a lot of gun companies. I don't think you saw the same thing this time. I think they all thought Trump was going to win. He did win. They expected perhaps lower demand. And I think they're probably better positioned to handle that this time around too.
I suspect that you're right about that. All right, Stephen, thank you again for coming on the program. Be sure to check out thereload.com. Be sure to sign up for the Reload. You don't even have to sign up for the Reload podcast, right? I mean, you can just access it.
It's free.
Whenever. So YouTube. There you go. On every week, Stephen does a great podcast focusing on Second Amendment news and issues. I am always honored when I get a chance to be on the show. Yes. But Reload.com, sign up to become a member. And Stephen Gutowski, thank you as always, my friend. It's good to see you today.
Thank you.
And thanks once again to Steve for joining us on the program. Always enjoy talking with him. And yeah, we're going to have to keep our eyes out, I think, for, again, whether or not this is a blip or a trend in terms of gun sales and what the quote unquote new normal is. I think that there are a number of factors involved. And, if this really is the result of, let's say, complacency, right? People who feel like, well, you know, I'm not that concerned about my rights being taken away. Just look at what's going on in Colorado, right, with SB 3, the sweeping semi-auto bill that has been amended, right, to essentially be a permit to purchase, right? If you want to own an AR-15, you have to apply for a permit. You have to show proof of training. That is not what the gun control advocates really want. They want a pure gun ban bill. And one is up for consideration in the state of New Mexico, a gas-operated semi-auto ban that would ban all gas-operated semi-automatic firearms that are acceptable, that can accept a detachable magazine. That's the new standard. And listen, I wish that the Supreme Court had already ruled that these types of laws were unconstitutional. They have not. And I don't know that they will anytime soon. I hate to say it, but we've been waiting on the Supreme Court to take action in Snope for a couple of months now. I don't know what the holdup is, but there's no guarantee that they're going to even accept that case. So, you know, listen, I'm not as concerned over the next couple of years about gun control legislation passing at the federal level. But I am also not under the misconception that our Second Amendment rights are safe and secure just because Donald Trump got elected. The gun control lobby plays the long game, and they don't just use one avenue of attack, right? If they can't get things done at the federal level, they'll move to the states. They'll move to cities. You know, they're involved in electing anti-gun school board members, not just anti-gun Congress critters, not just trying to get Joe Biden reelected or Kamala Harris. Joe Biden. Well, they did come out and endorse Joe Biden, actually, really early. And then, of course, they swung their endorsement to Kamala Harris. Anyway, the point being, they're not giving up and they're not going away. And we cannot afford to rest on our laurels, both in terms of our Second Amendment activism. And frankly, again, you know, if you've been holding off on buying a firearm because no big deal, depending on where you live, your rights very much may be in doubt, and your ability to purchase popular firearms, some of the most commonly owned firearms in the country, may very well be curtailed in the immediate or not too distant future. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Colorado where a man accused of vehicular assault in a Boulder County crash 2 years ago has been sentenced to work release and probation. Yeah, how about that? 20-year-old Phoenix Carl Kirkman was initially charged with vehicular assault, DUI, vehicular assault, reckless, and reckless endangerment. One person was seriously injured during this crash in which Kirkman was apparently driving under the influence back in February of 2023. But back on December the 6th, Kirkman pleaded guilty to vehicular assault, DUI. And after he pleaded guilty to that single charge, all of the remaining charges were dismissed. Now, sentencing didn't take place until February 28th. And according to the Boulder Daily Camera, Kirkman was sentenced to 2 years of probation and a year of work release. So, no time behind bars for this. According to the Daily Camera, stipulations of his sentence include 120 days of community service, no drugs unless prescribed, no alcohol, no marijuana. Again, he's 20. He's not old enough to legally drink or smoke cannabis under Colorado law, so I'm not sure why that was even a condition of his probation, whatever. Level 2 DUI treatment, no driving without a valid license or insurance, and a Mothers Against Drunk Driving victim impact panel. Okay. You know, I say that he was not sentenced to jail time. Apparently, the year of work release requires him to remain in custody at the jail, except when he is allowed out for work assignments during the day. So I guess that's a little bit of a mitigating factor. I mean, it's kind of like being grounded, except that you're not spending your nights at home. You're spending your nights at a secure facility. The prosecutor in this case said this conduct was incredibly serious. So his guilty plea to the highest charge and the felony conviction on his record is certainly appropriate. After carefully considering the aggravated and mitigating factors, including the victim's input and Kirkman's difficult upbringing, the court's pre-sentence investigation report recommended a sentence of probation with work release. I got to say, I'm still not convinced that that is appropriate. you know, particularly again, when we are seeing Colorado Democrats talk about how serious it is to own a semi-automatic firearm, right? And we got to ban these things. Why does anybody need these weapons of war? And then you see something like this. Somebody gets behind the wheel of a vehicle, right? Nobody's trying to ban cars, by the way, not even in Colorado. Causes serious injury to somebody while driving under the influence. And is offered a plea deal. Now, it may have been that the plea deal was plead guilty to the most serious charge, but those underlying charges were dropped. And Kirkman could have been sentenced to prison time. And instead, he was not. And the year of work release, by the way, I don't think it's actually going to be a year. As long as he stays out of trouble, that year is likely to be reduced down to 6 months or less. And he may already be getting credit for time served. So, you know, the sentence that individuals receive is most of the time, despite truth in sentencing laws, not what they will actually do. And I believe that to be the case here. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. This from the Lone Star State of Texas. Jasper County, an incident that happened last Monday where a burglar held at gunpoint until a Jasper County deputy arrived on the scene to take the individual into custody. Happened about 2 a.m. last Monday morning at a home in rural Jasper County on Farm to Market Road 2246. According to the report by the Jasper County Sheriff's Department, the homeowner woke up and found a man burglarizing his vehicle. Had already stolen multiple items, including a gun that was left inside the car. This individual later identified as 65-year-old Anthony Andre Threet. Told the deputy later that he stole the items in order to buy crack cocaine. The homeowner, again, spotting Threet, held him at gunpoint, called 911, waited for authorities to arrive, where he was taken into custody without incident, thankfully. The stolen firearm was recovered along with the other property that Threet had allegedly taken from the vehicle. Threet was taken to the Jasper County Jail, charged with burglary of a vehicle and theft of a firearm. I would say we'll keep our eyes open for any more details of this story, but honestly, I doubt we will get any more updates to this story out of Jasper County, Texas. But if we do, I will certainly let you know about it. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A man in Old Hickory, Tennessee, who came to the aid of his neighbor. The headline, I wish I could have gotten there sooner. Man pulls woman out of a burning Old Hickory home. It happened last month, about February the 10th, I guess it was. According to a WSMV in Nashville, Barbara Partlow was watching TV. All of a sudden, she heard folks yelling outside. She ran outside and she saw that her neighbor's home was engulfed in flames. She said it was just horrible. And then she realized that her neighbor was still inside the home. She wondered, how do we get her out? But she said before she could move, another neighbor, a guy by the name of Brian Perry, rushed inside that burning residence. He said he opened the sliding door in the back of the home. He had to crawl through the smoke. He saw the resident inside on the floor. He said, I put my shirt over her face. I started crawling in as low to the ground as I could. He said, I thought she was deceased. She had her phone on her chest. It was steadily ringing, and her right arm and her right leg were on fire. So he was able to put out the flames, and then he started pulling the woman out of the burning building. He said, we got into the kitchen, and that's when the whole roof area just fell in. He said, it was awful. It got all in my face, burned my hair, my shirt caught on fire. He said, I had to get her out. A couple of seconds, he said, after he was able to remove her from the home, fire trucks and an ambulance pulled in. And Perry said, we were just in there praying for her, just trying to keep talking to her, telling her everything was going to be okay. Unfortunately, Barbara Partlow says that her friend and neighbor passed away shortly after the fire because of the severe burns. Situation she described as heartbreaking. And it absolutely is. But the fact that she passed away does not change the heroism displayed by Brian Perry that night. He was asked by WSMV why he did this. And he said, I didn't think of anything else. He said, I just wanted to get her out because I didn't want to see someone get burned alive. That's just awful. He said, I wish I could have gotten there sooner, but I did all I could. And at least her family can say their proper goodbyes. You know, I wish that the story had a happier ending too. I do. But again, that does not take away from the actions of Brian Perry, risking his own life to save his neighbor. That, I think, is worthy of acknowledgement and respect. And so Brian Perry, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to save someone in need. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Hey, listen, I would encourage you to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. Keep me up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. And we've got a great deal right now on VIP memberships. If you want to support the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing, just use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your VIP membership. You'll get all kinds of exclusive benefits at whatever tier you decide to join, VIP, VIP Gold, VIP Platinum. And again, you will definitely be supporting the work that we're doing at Bearing Arms. We greatly appreciate that support. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, enjoy your Hump Day Wednesday, weekend in sight. And we'll see you soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.